Welcome to Life and Sirens, Behind and On the Scene, a podcast by first responders. We're your hosts, Sophie,
Jamie,
and Aubrey.
The content provided in this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of any medical institutions, emergency medical services, or healthcare organizations. Patient privacy is a top priority, and all discussions involving real-world emergency situations are de-identified and altered to ensure confidentiality. Always consult with a qualified healthcare professional or your local EMS protocols before making any decisions regarding patient care or medical practices. Listener discretion is advised, as some topics may include discussions of real-world emergency situations.
Welcome to another episode of Life and Sirens. Today we're talking about anaphylaxis and kind of all the weird ways that anaphylaxis can present. We'll dive into complex world of anaphylaxis from the classic and atypical to even rare cases of status anaphylaxis. We'll also explore alpha-gal syndrome, a meat allergy caused by tick bites, and anaphylaxis during blood product administration. Whether you're an EMS, an emergency department, or just curious about critical care, this episode equips you to handle these emergencies with confidence, hopefully. But as we get into things, you'll see that anaphylaxis isn't always straightforward.
So what we're going to start doing every episode is we're going to do a trivia question. And so this one's a critical care trivia question. Fancy pants. Which of the following best describes how epinephrine influences anaphylaxis? A. It directly blocks H1 and H2 histamine receptors, preventing histamine binding. B. It stabilizes mast cells, preventing further histamine release into circulation. C. It counteracts histamine effects by reversing vasodilation and bronchoconstriction. D. It neutralizes circulating histamine by enzymatic degradation.
And the answer, you're going to find out at the end. Sorry.
Anaphylaxis takes many forms, some obvious, others subtle, but all of them are life-threatening. Today, we are going to uncover the signs and treatments you need to know to save lives when every second counts.
Dun, dun, dun!
Dun, dun, dun!
So, Aubrey, you want to start us off with the classic anaphylaxis and kind of traditionally what we see?
Absolutely. So the definition of anaphylaxis is a multi-system allergic reaction with rapid onset, typically involving skin, respiratory, and cardiovascular symptoms. The most common triggers are foods, so like peanut allergies, shellfish allergies, medications. You know, everybody and their mom is allergic to penicillin.
And sulfa.
Yes, ma'am. And then you can see it in things like insect stings, typically bees, wasps, things of that nature. The signs and symptoms that you'll see, you can have urticaria, angioedema, wheezing, stridor. Stridor is a very ominous sign, but we'll get into more of that. Cardiovascularly, you will see hypotension, tachycardia, your best management and also your first line management is going to be epinephrine to the rescue. And then you'll have oxygen, IV fluids, all of those things.
What are some of the adjunct treatments that we do in the setting of anaphylaxis once we've obviously administered epinephrine, which is the only thing really that's going to solve our main issue, but other symptoms and things like that, how do we treat those?
We also give Benadryl. We'll give a steroid, so like we carry dexamethasone. Also albuterol.
Yep. Other things you might see are duodenum racemic epinephrine. That's a big one in anaphylaxis, which a lot of EMS services I understand don't carry, but that's okay. And then other steroids might look like Solumedrol, and you may see other antihistamines like Pepcid given as well.
Yep.
So the classic presentation is just going to be, for example, you have a kid with, you know, a known peanut allergy, develops wheezing, maybe some facial swelling, you know he ate a cookie. It's usually pretty straightforward that something is happening here. Most people do know, and they usually carry EpiPens. I will say, as I've experienced and many of us have, a lot of the times we see, especially in settings where the caretaker isn't the primary caretaker, the EpiPen may be administered when it maybe wasn't necessary. I have a big problem with us getting mad at people for administering Epi too soon. There's just, it's okay. It's really not going
to
hurt him.
I would so much rather you give Epi, especially to these little kiddos that can really handle it. They can support
exactly.
That. I'd so much rather you give it early than wait until you think it's serious, because at that point they may need way more than that.
Right, and way more interventions and airway management. So I know that sometimes we have people who are not healthcare providers administering these rescue medications. They did what they thought was best. Just keep that in mind when you're dealing with these patients, families, and caretakers.
For sure. And that was probably the scariest moment for them to have
Definitely.
To, like, stab their kid with an EpiPen.
Yes, it's a very aggressive. I know that we don't use EpiPens typically in EMS or healthcare. We draw it up nice and easy. We give you a little shot in a TV syringe with a tiny 25 gauge needle. It is not like that. If you've ever seen an EpiPen be administered, it's quite excessive, but it has to be.
It's spring loaded.
It
it's
hurts.
Like a giant lancet.
It's that giant. Just... it is, and it's so long. We'll do a video about that probably.
Yeah, and a lot of them now will talk to you when you open it, and so it will start saying.
It's like a cartridge.
Yeah, it'll start saying things. So that's our typical presentation of anaphylaxis that we see a lot when people have known allergies, and a lot of times they'll call you before they start really showing like huge signs and symptoms of it. But there's also atypical anaphylaxis, and so anaphylaxis without hallmark symptoms such as hives or a rapid onset. So an example of this could be isolated respiratory symptoms, such as a severe bronchospasm. You can have GI symptoms, severe abdominal pain, nausea. So some of the challenges with an atypical presentation is that it's going to be misdiagnosed, or there's delayed recognition because the signs are subtle. But the management, especially if you suspect anaphylaxis, is going to be early epi. Try to get that on board as quickly as you can. So an example of a case study of this would be a patient with severe abdominal pain. They're hypotensive after they took a new antibiotic. They don't have hives. They don't have any respiratory symptoms present. But the hypotension and the abdominal pain is indicative of, one, you have some shunting going on.
Yep.
Your body is trying to get all of that blood to a more important area. And the hypotension is going to be that mass vasodilation that you see with the distributive shock. And so those are your indicators that you probably do have an allergic reaction or an anaphylactic reaction going on, and you want to take your anaphylactic steps.
And with atypical anaphylaxis, really the most important tool you're going to have is using context clues. It's usually sudden onset symptoms. Just weird. You're like, that's freaking weird. What have you been up to? What were you doing when this started? What were you doing before this started? Like, really your patient interview is going to be the most important thing.
Yeah, and there's oftentimes a change in routine, a change in environment, a change in exposure, a new medication. A lot of times there's something that they've done recently that's going to be different. Now, if you have a poor historian and they're not very good at telling you what they did today, yesterday, what they're going to do, like they don't have a clue, then this presentation will be harder for you to identify if you really are suspicious of anaphylaxis or not, especially if you have an older patient. Because that adds a comorbidity complication.
Yeah, and just remember anaphylaxis, whether it's typical or atypical, you just have to have two body systems. So once you have that second body system and you have this high suspicion, it's much safer to go ahead and give the epi, even though we're thinking a lot of the times we're so worried about respiratory involvement and airway management, and that's, I think, a classical indication of we need to give epi. Well, you can also die from vasodilation, and it needs to be treated just the same. The only solution to anaphylaxis is epi.
Absolutely. And the patients that you want to be cautious in are those geriatric patients that are going to be a little bit more susceptible to different changes. And that does not mean don't give epi. It just means go through your differentials and make sure that your suspicion is high enough for that disease process.
Status at anaphylaxis. This is wild and terrifying. Aubrey's going to tell us all about it, but just remember that this doesn't mean necessarily that your patient just didn't respond to treatment. It may mean that their trigger for their anaphylaxis was so significant that they were treated for the symptoms. Like maybe they received an EpiPen at home. They thought things were going to get better. They took some Benadryl at home maybe. And then the symptoms reoccurred. So just like a status seizure, for example, is either a short period of time in between resolution of symptoms or no resolution of symptoms and just persistent scary anaphylaxis symptoms.
Yeah, definitely the scariest of the anaphylaxis. Yes. So like Soph already said, you'll have some biphasic reactions. These symptoms will be refractory. They will not respond to multiple doses of epinephrine, like your IM injections. So what do you do? What's the next step?
Well, first of all, if you've given multiple doses of epi and things are not necessarily improving, or they improved and now they're getting worse again, it doesn't mean you're wrong with your anaphylaxis dose. So just keep that in mind. Like, you're treating this patient for anaphylaxis for a reason, and you need to be persistent. This does happen. It's rare, but it does happen. So it needs to be treated aggressively and managed aggressively, beyond the classic. You've given multiple rounds of epi, you've given steroids, you've given the antihistamine, you've probably given in some nebulized treatments, but the patient is either continuing to decline or has returned to an anaphylaxis. For us, your standing orders might not be there, but you could always call for orders. If you don't have orders for racemic epi, you could call for inhaled epi, and we can get into that about how you make that. And there's some people sometimes get upset when you nebulize epi when it's not the racemic form, but it can be done.
Bougie.
It can be done. And if it's necessary, it's necessary. So you can always call for orders. Usually the ER doc knows exactly what you're talking about when you're explaining that you don't have racemic epi, but you have this form and this is how I'm going to give this medication. And then also epi infusions. So sometimes that's unfortunately just necessary. We hate epi infusions. They're uncomfortable for the patient, and there sometimes are a lot of ebb and flow of symptoms like hypertension and things like that, but we'd much rather than be experiencing maybe some mild hypertension, tachycardia, than apnea because their airway is closed.
With refractory anaphylaxis or status anaphylaxis, it's responsible as a provider to go back down through your differentials and just reconfirm that you're on the right path. But don't doubt yourself too much, because odds are you probably are and you're in a status anaphylaxis situation. Also, as far as racemic or inhaled epi go, I feel like a lot of times the argument is around like which one's better. Well, that's not an argument. Racemic is better.
Yeah.
But if you don't have racemic, then sometimes sometimes you just got to do what you got to do. And so I think sometimes people get really grumpy about that.
Yes,
argument.
Just call for your orders. It can be done, just like you can make your own EpiDrip, your dirty EpiDrip. You can do these things.
Yeah, that argument does not exist when all you have is epi and you're in a tin box down a highway. So like, I'm going to give the inhaled epi.
Yeah, I cannot, unfortunately. I kind of wish I could, but I cannot just request that pharmacy bring me down some racemic.
Wait a second, Amazon drones. Hold up, what if that starts to be a thing?
Did you just come
pharmacy
up with a
drones?
Million dollar idea?
Okay, we have to cut that or else everyone's gonna know.
Everyone's gonna know. Pharmacy EMS drones.
Hell yeah.
You call for orders, doc's like, I got like, you. Beep, 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 pharmacy beep. Flies you a drone, drops you your meds.
I like it.
Honestly. All right, we're gonna add that to the list.
I like it.
We'll talk about that later. One thing I do want to mention, if you don't know the mechanism or what has incited this anaphylaxis and it's continuing to progress despite treatment, or it's returned, or it's continuing to return over and over again despite treatment, you may want to do some things like get your patient naked. Is it something on them? Did they come into contact with some kind of lotion or powder or detergent or something that for some reason they're having some extreme reaction to.
Yeah, are they having like a repeat exposure?
Right. Is what they were exposed to still present?
Yeah. So what do you guys, what's your line for like a status anaphylaxis? Like at what point are you like, I need to RSI them? Like at what point are you choosing to take their airway?
I think I'd be more inclined to take an airway in a situation where, in the field, where the patient is continuing to go from anaphylaxis to a state of like no symptoms or limited or diminished symptoms and back into anaphylaxis. And maybe I would feel more comfortable that maybe there's less of a chance that they're going to decompensate during an RSI.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know that there is a specific line for me. If I'm concerned about it, I think I might get medical control on board, because that's kind of a scary thing. Because what if you get in and their edema is so significant?
You really have like one shot and you don't want to make it worse. I think my line is really, and again, it's not a hard line. It's very much like how your patient presents. But it is when we arrive on scene and we are so far down.
Right, which is definitely possible.
Right, that at this point, the risk of not being able to maintain your airway in the event that intervention does not work, like, we just can't risk that. Like, we had a call it's been a few years now, mm-hmm. It sounded like a shellfish exposure. But this patient was actually on the side of the road. They were in a car. We're on the side of the road, and we got there, and we were declined to the point that, like, we had to intervene with their airway immediately.
Do it sooner than later.
Yeah, but that was the only time that I've ever been... It has been that stark. Like, oh, we got to tube them.
And a lot of these patients, if they have allergies that significant, either A, they have been equally as sick or have been intubated in the past. Mm-hmm. So that's a question you can ask, just like...
Have you ever been intubated before?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Really be confident with what you're doing and make a decision and really go down that path. This is one of those situations where if you are not confident in your course of care that you've chosen, and you're kind of wish-washing back and forth, your patient can decline really quickly while you're doing that.
Also, one thing to be aware of is that your patient could have other underlying respiratory conditions that could cloud lung sounds. So like you could have other lung sounds going on that could be indicative of other disease processes, but be sure to remember that when you're experiencing anaphylaxis and you're meeting all the other criteria, that people experiencing anaphylaxis can also have other medical problems.
Right. You know how we always say like not all that wheezes is asthma?
Yeah.
Well, I feel like not all that is anaphylaxis is Strider. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, like you can have...
That's pretty extreme if we get to Strider.
Yeah. You can have plenty of other presentations.
Just like you could have pneumonia and you could also be in anaphylaxis. Just because you have those crackles does not mean that you don't have anaphylaxis. Mm-hmm. So just be aware that there could be other conditions, especially when people are having anaphylactic reactions to like medications or patients are receiving medications actively. Like if you're working in the ICU or ER... type setting or a transport setting where they've initiated some drugs and kicked you out the door immediately. Yeah. Just be sure that we are troubleshooting things. Do we need to stop some medications? Do we need to give some antihistamines? And then later we're going to talk about, you know, blood product administration and anaphylaxis in that setting too.
Is it not just the worst that patients don't exist in a vacuum?
Man, it is.
That like you could have more than one thing wrong with you?
Sick, critical patients usually have a million other things.
Yeah, and they really brushed over that in school. They're like, this is the box that your patient will live in. And then you get out there and you're like, okay, well, there's currently 17. We're in a trailer park. There's 17 boxes that this person is living in. It's wild. It's wild out there.
It really is wild. And it starts to be nobody ever, and it's hard to teach clearly, but nobody is ever like, this is what this disease process looks like in the context of these other four disease processes.
Yep.
But you just kind of figure that out on the fly.
What's going to kill him first?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Treat that.
All right. So what is alpha-gal? What is that?
I'm so excited. So this is interesting. And I think this is where some providers can get like annoyed with patients because they're like, that is not how that works. It might be how it works. You're just not educated on it. So let's be real. We don't know everything all the time, but we're about to learn you something right now if you don't already know. Alpha-gal syndrome. It's a delayed allergic reaction to mammalian meat, so beef, things like that, caused by the Lone Star tick. So,
Texas.
Yeah, ticks also are always just destroying things, causing some weird syndromes and conditions. So alpha-gal is caused by ticks. The Lone Star tick is, there's like a little brown tick with a little fleck on his back, and that's the Lone Star tick. So symptoms don't appear usually until 3 to 6 hours after the ingestion of the meat.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah, and symptoms are usually like abdominal pain, diarrhea, the hives, the edema, things like that, difficulty breathing, the classic anaphylaxis syndromes, respiratory distress. Obviously, we are going to treat this just like any other anaphylaxis. I know it appeared at a weird time. Usually, this is like, someone has eaten dinner, they've gone to bed, and now they're waking up in anaphylaxis. First of all, terrifying. Second of all, take that seriously. That's crazy. That's crazy.
It's terrifying.
They need epi. They need all the supportive interventions that you're going to see in any other setting of anaphylaxis. The antihistamines, the steroids. Like, do what you got to do. Treat how you got to treat. And I know that it's weird. And that you're going to be like, what do you mean? You didn't eat anything weird? Because typically, these patients, like I said, it's a delayed reaction. Plus, they weren't born with the tick bite. Okay, so this is just one day they've woken up after some exposure to this Lone Star tick. And this is happening to them. So, it's usually adult patients. You got to treat it aggressively. It's the same thing. It's just the cause is a little bit different. And it's about a protein that is found in these mammalian meats that the Lone Star tick has decided to screw with your immune system, and consider that an invader to it. So, still anaphylaxis, just very weird onset, I would say. Usually, obviously, we see sudden onset of symptoms immediately after the encounter with the allergen. This is just so delayed that it's often missed. But it's going to keep happening because most people who are meat eaters are going to continue to eat meat and not realize this is the cause. So definitely make sure we are getting all the information. What was your last meal? Have you been recently in contact with the wilderness? Have you had a tick bite, etc.? So that we can get that to the providers at the receiving facility. So
that would just be a really difficult one to identify if you weren't familiar. Because I don't know that I would, if I was like, what'd you eat for dinner? And they just said, like, steak.
Yeah.
I'd be like, yeah, me too.
Yeah, same. Like, I don't know that I would immediately identify that as strange, especially, I'd be like, do you have an allergy to meat? And they'd say, no.
Well, it's initially a little bit of an atypical response because it usually starts with abdominal pain, cramping, diarrhea, possibly vomiting.
And if that's what you get called for initially,
and then it progresses to these other classical anaphylaxis symptoms like urticaria, angioedema, difficulty breathing. So it is odd.
Are these presentations often caught in the ER long term because they come in with nausea, vomiting, and then they develop that quickly, or does it happen relatively fast?
Between the abdominal GI symptoms.
Yeah, like, would we see
fast.
That? It
yeah,
is, okay.
You may see it in transport. I'd say when I did a deep dive, usually the abdominal pain, diarrhea, it's not, like, so crazy that this person they might not call 911 for that. They might not even mention it because they can't breathe right now.
Gotcha, okay.
So, and typically these patients are going to have reoccurrent episodes, and they're not going to figure it out in the ER. They're going to send them to an allergist, and ultimately that's who's going to diagnose this, hopefully, because it can kill.
Unless you call 911 and get Soph.
Yeah. EMS nerd.
Yeah, now she's going to be like, hey, you've been outside recently.
Have you ever looked at the sun?
Do you enjoy the wilderness and eat the meats?
Did you hunt this meat that you ate last night?
He said, well, yeah, it's deer season.
Here's something that I am excited for you guys to talk about, because I am very unfamiliar with this, but I've heard so much about this. Like, everybody, I feel like, that goes to critical care school is like, I'm terrified of giving blood because of this.
But it's so rare, so calm down.
All right, see, that's great to know.
I feel like that is the definition of paramedic anything, though, is I'm right. Like, okay, I will see this every single day of my paramedic career. Mm-hmm. And then you get out here, and it just doesn't happen that often. I think that allergic reactions during blood product administration is one of those.
Even just anaphylaxis is kind of rare, because last shift, we actually had one, and I came, the next shift came in, and I was like, guys, we actually had a real anaphylaxis, because it just doesn't happen. And we gave the Epi and the Benadryl and the Dex and all the things, and that just is, it is rare. Mm-hmm. It is rare. So, especially rare in the setting of blood product administration. Jamie, you want to kick us off? We'll kind of bounce back off of each other for this guy.
For sure. So, when you're administering blood, you always say, like, as far as paramedics are concerned, depending on what state you're in, a lot of times you can transport but not initiate unless you're critical care, and then you can initiate. But if you're transporting and not initiating, like on a transfer, you hang out for like 15 minutes or so to make sure that they don't have a reaction to the blood. So it can occur during your transfusion of those blood products, like plasma, platelets, or red blood cells. So it doesn't just have to be whole blood. Something that I think is very interesting, we'll go through the causes here in a sec, but one thing that I think is really interesting is that you have less allergic reactions with the administration of whole blood because you have less donors. So in my brain for a long time, if you were getting plasma, platelets, packed red blood cells,
weird things,
whatever it was, in my brain, those were all the same donor because I just didn't think through it very much. But you can have like between 6 and 8 donors when you're getting FFP, packed red blood cells, whatever it is. And with whole blood, you normally have closer to 2. So it can help a lot with allergic reaction. But so if go through the causes that you'll see.
So typically, obviously, this is a scary one. They got the wrong blood.
Yeah.
And that's why we go through the process of like double checking and things like that. And like in the field, there's only certain types of blood that are administered, you know, blood types, O neg, O positive.
And if you guys have a hard time identifying blood types and what's compatible with what, Google a Punnett square. They're very fun. You learn about it in genetics, but it can help you align your blood types and what can be given to who.
So usually, obviously, if it's the wrong blood, we have a big problem. But not necessarily is it, you know, the staff's fault. It could have been bagged improperly. So one thing to remember, if you do have a patient in transport who is receiving blood and they have a reaction, obviously stop the blood. And if possible, please return that blood to the sending facility so they can send it back to their lab to have it test to be sure that this patient didn't receive the wrong blood by mistake.
Yeah, that it wasn't like labeled inappropriately. Yeah.
That's a really important factor. Also, they can test for contamination. And then also blood products have preservatives in them.
Especially if you've never received blood before. Because a lot of times, especially in these like massive traumas, you could be a really young, healthy person that's never gotten a transfusion. And so you don't know that you're allergic to X, Y, and Z that is in the products.
Yes. And there is a difference between a negative response or reaction to a blood product and an allergic or anaphylactic reaction. There's other reactions that can happen, like rarely, but they do happen, such as like pulmonary edema, things like that, like weird things. That is still something you need to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would that have to do more with like mast cell activation and things like that, like an eosinophil issue?
Yes. And just because, something to think about, just because a patient has, for example, low hematocrit or low hemoglobin, does not mean they have low fluid volume.
Oh. Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
It does make sense.
Yeah, so just because they got less
they
little...
They could still have CHF.
Yeah, just because they're...
Just because they have tiny little bleed. Blood cells.
Yeah.
Yes, they could have small
does
blood cells.
Does not mean... They have small little RBs.
Yeah.
They does don't have enough fluid.
Yes, they could still have runs enough around. Volume.
That makes sense.
That does make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So you could truly volume overload them.
Right. It does. It can't happen.
Because the carrier products is what they really need.
I was actually reading a PubMed article about, maybe I'll be able to find it again, about patients who have multiple conditions being treated simultaneously, and patients who may have low blood counts but also are experiencing like CHF. These are like extremely critically ill patients, like in the ICU. But I was talking about giving blood products and giving Lasix.
I was going to say, would you kind of pair the two? Because the volume's not what you need, but you need the, I guess, the solute that's inside the volume.
So something to think about. Also, another thing to think about while we're on the topic, just because your patient's hypotensive in a trauma scenario does not mean they need blood, okay? Just so you know.
Ooh.
Wait, explain.
Explain.
Neurogenic shock.
Duh.
That didn't make it sense.
Everybody forgets. When I was in medic school, I don't know if this happened to y'all, but when I was in medic school, we just really skirted over neurogenic shock. It was basically like we talked real in depth about all of the other shocks. And the neurogenic shock, we're like, yeah, things get broken by.
The first trauma I ever had was neurogenic shock. It was a partial ejection from a, like, through a windshield of a vehicle. And it was true. I'm bradycardic, hypotensive. Initial pressure was 40.
Dang.
And I was like, my first thought, I'm a baby new medic. I'm like, he needs blood. I need to call air. Air was not flying. And honestly, like.
Probably good.
He really needed, like, a pressor.
Yeah, you really have to go through your differentials of
most
what.
Most people, it's not going
to
hurt them.
Yeah, of what shock process you think they're in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because a lot of times you're right. We see trauma. We immediately go to hypovolemia. We've got to bleed somewhere. Yep. And a lot of times that's more common.
It is more common.
But
that was so rare. The fact that I saw that as my first major trauma out of school was honestly on brand for me. But
yeah, it's really on point with life.
I was internally panicking. Just so you know, when you think blood, just think of all the things.
Yeah,
just remember, there is a miscellaneous traumatic shock that does not involve blood.
Yeah. He probably did need blood eventually.
Miscellaneous.
I did fly through a window.
I feel like that's how they categorize neurogenic shock. They're like, anyway, miscellaneous category. Psychogenic shock, neurogenic shock, bye.
Literally, they did.
So you get yourself into a situation. You are doing the blood things. You see sudden respiratory distress, hypotension, or shock during transfusion, which would be such a bummer. If you are already in shock and now you are like, wow.
Can you imagine? That's so rude.
More that is so shock.
Rude. Shock, right? Squared.
So it says may overlap with febrile or septic transfusion reactions.
Oh, yeah. Hyperthermic reactions. Stop that blood. That's not something we monitor, though, typically in the field.
Okay.
So just think about that. Unless some monitors in critical care setting, like there's a Zoll feature where you can, it has a temperature probe that you can plug in, which is quite delightful. But just remember that you might not have.
Yeah.
Think about the other signs you're gonna.
Yeah, if you're managing your temperature with a tympanic probe.
Yeah, just throw it in the trash.
Yeah. Just see if they feel hot. I guess. Don't follow that advice.
There's other symptoms, you know, fever though. If they have some changes in sudden changes in vital signs, like we become more tachycardic instead of less tachycardic because we're replacing volume. Things like that could be a sign of hypothermia.
Like a high suspicion that maybe we're having a reaction to the blood. So what do you do? So if this is all happening and you realize that they are reacting to the blood, what's your plan?
Well, our plan is to A, stop that thing, completely stop it, flush the line, get rid of it. Yeah, it's okay to flush the line. It's like, oh, they already got the blood. Like, just get rid of that thing. Put it in a biohazard bag and bring it back to the facility that sent you with it because something is amiss. It could be the patient's end or it could be the lab end. So just be sure that we are returning that to the sending facility if possible so they can test it. And this may be in your protocols if you routinely transfer blood or are in a critical care setting. And then you just treat it the same way.
Well, that's easy enough.
Just treat it the same way.
Stop blood, give meds. Mm-hmm. I like it.
There's also determining what has caused it, if it's anaphylaxis, can occasionally be a little tricky, but it is far safer to treat the anaphylaxis. What's your hypotensive patient going to do?
Get less hypotensive.
Wow.
Oh my gosh, so scary.
So, epinephrine, antihistamines, and then classic supportive care.
Maybe I feel like a lot of the anaphylaxis presentations in general is like your risk versus reward. Like, what is our worst case scenario? And is what I'm doing going to worsen that outcome or improve that outcome?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, some tips. Tips and tricks.
Always prioritize epinephrine in suspected anaphylaxis. Always carry multiple doses. Don't, draw up your epi and then throw... I know those ampules are annoying to keep up with, but hopefully... I hope that you carry more than one ampule, but...
I sure hope so.
Me too.
Goodness. But just always be ready that your patient might require more than one dose. Always have that dose ready.
As far as also like repeat doses go, if you find yourself in a situation where you've had multiple anaphylaxis in one day, I don't know the plural for anaphylaxis.
Anaphylaxis.
Me too. I think it's probably just anaphylactic, like moose.
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very underwhelming.
Yes, it is. But if you've had multiple anaphylaxis in one day and you are just really running low on that epi 1:1, if you are confident in your drug and dose calculations and you can do math, you can use 1:10.
Yeah.
You just have to understand your dilution.
We all remember about that airline pilot. Does anyone remember that?
No.
He gave cardiac epi because the airline only had cardiac epi in their emergency kit.
That seems less
necessary. Yeah. Don't even get me started. All right. That's crazy.
Did he give the whole thing IM? What are you
trying to
say?
He gave the dose IM.
Like the 10 mLs?
No.
Oh, but he gave the correct dose.
Yes. Yeah.
Ooh, get it, math man.
What's the starting dose for epi? IM.
0.3.
So you don't have to get the 1 mg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
I think he gave multiple injections from what I remember. He just had to be like, here, sorry, sir.
Sorry.
There's a lot of volume, my friend.
Hi, me again.
Give me your
I've been trying to reach you about your epi's extended warranty.
Yes. Okay, this kind of goes along with your patient might require multiple doses. Always monitor for biphasic reactions, so like that refractory anaphylaxis. Your symptoms can reoccur. They can reoccur up to hours later, so it might not be something that you see in the truck, but it should be something that you should always be ready to see in the truck. Ask the right questions for blood product reactions. Inquire about IgA deficiency or other previous transfusion history. And that is something I know that we come into contact with a lot of people that are very poor historians. But once people have a blood transfusion, they typically remember that. And especially if they had a reaction to that transfusion, they usually remember that.
And they will typically tell you about that.
Yes.
Also, good questions to ask is, like, have you had outdoors exposure? Have you been in the forest?
Have you done anything
have
that you don't typically do?
Have you gone on a walk? Yep. Have you eaten any different foods?
What
have you changed your detergent? Have you? This is one of those situations where it actually does become very pertinent to know what your patient's life is normally like and what it has been like recently. Because those are going to be all your indicators for a recent exposure.
This is one of those patients I feel like you can't ask too many questions. Like, you can't get, because let's think about this. We are the ones that are going into their environment. We are the ones that are able to see them where they came from. And we are taking this very sick human and we are dropping them off of at a facility that is not able to see any of those. So all of the pertinent information that you can gather and then relay is actually very important.
Absolutely.
Definitely. And that's just an always thing. Like, you guys have so much valuable information out in the field. Just, you're observant.
Mm-hmm.
You're inquisitive. I know you are. So just keep those things in mind.
You guys want to play a fun game?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. Close your eyes. Myth or fact? If there's no rash, it's not anaphylaxis.
Myth.
Why is it a myth?
Because all you need is two body systems, and nobody said that the body system has to be your skin, girl.
Boom. Good. Skin symptoms are not required for a diagnosis. Not everybody's going to have hives. You ready for another one?
Yep.
Myth or fact? Delaying epinephrine is far more dangerous than giving it unnecessarily.
Fact. Scream it from the rooftops.
The myth is that epinephrine is dangerous. We talked earlier about risk versus reward. A lot of times the risk by not giving the medication is far worse. It outweighs the reward for not giving the medication. There are a couple. Yes. There's a couple populations that you need to just be cautious with. Being cautious just means being a good clinician and thinking through your systems. It does not mean not administering that medication.
That is why when you look up any EMS protocols everywhere and you look under epinephrine, it says no contraindications in the emergency setting.
Guys, I have a question.
Bingo.
What about those patients that you get that tell you they are allergic to Epi?
This happened to us one time, and I thought it was really funny. You're not. This was in the computer of the hospital, and it said tachycardia.
Okay. Well. Yep.
So some humans do have a bit of a less than pleasant reaction to Epi because of the sometimes people, there's preservatives in every drug. Sometimes people, their bodies do not like the preservative, and in any other circumstance, they would be allergic to said preservative. However, the Epi is going to counteract that.
Yes, and some symptoms.
So it may not be pleasant, but...
Or side effects of Epi are typically because of the sudden vasoconstriction. So like headache, nausea, vomiting, anxiety, things like that, tachycardia. It's because of the sudden like onset of the vasodilation or vasoconstriction. I apologize. Mm-hmm. Sudden vasoconstriction is not comfortable.
No.
Our body doesn't do that on its own. Mm-mm.
So just remember the less than pleasant symptoms does not mean that they're anaphylactically allergic to Epi. It just means it's less than pleasant.
Yeah, give the Epi and be like, you're going to have a headache again. I'm so sorry.
Lo siento.
So sorry. But you will keep breathing.
There's good news and there's bad news.
Good news. So what are the things that I should remember?
Give Epi fast.
Recognize subtle presentations. The first time, I actually have anaphylactic reactions to some food items. The first encounter I had with tree nuts that caused an anaphylactic reaction, my symptoms, I did have hives, but I only had hives and I peed about every 5 minutes, like full bladder peed. It's a body system. You
know? I guess so, yeah.
That is, and it still happens to me. If I have anaphylaxis, I pee a lot.
Oh my goodness.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is so weird. I pee, I'm like, dang it, I'm going to have to bring out the Epi, like, because I'm just peeing so much. That's like the first thing that happens.
That is wild. So that is wild.
Yeah, it's weird. But there are some atypical symptoms. So let's remember that. Let's recognize the subtle ones. That's pretty subtle. I've been peeing a lot. recognize subtle or atypical presentations. And then early and aggressive epinephrine administration. And then remember there are weird like conditions or syndromes like alpha-gal syndrome and then transfusion-related anaphylaxis that you may come across that don't always fit your classic education that you've received up to this point. Just because you don't know about it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Well, that is on anaphylaxis. It can be fast, unpredictable, and unforgiving, or it can be slow, lazy, and still unforgiving. So just watch out. You never know what you're going to get yourself into. But Epi can make the difference, so please treat aggressively. Recently in the news, there was an influencer who died from anaphylaxis, so just because it's something we learn about often doesn't mean it doesn't kill people all the time.
If you stay ready and stay educated, then you guys can make a difference in anaphylaxis.
100%.
Together, we will end anaphylaxis.
I wish we could end it, but we might all interrupt right. it.
So, after all of our conversation about anaphylaxis and the fun little sidebar conversations that we have, I'm hoping that you figured out the answer to our trivia question. Drum roll. What is it?
What's the question?
The question was, which of the following best describes how epinephrine combats anaphylaxis?
And what were the possible options?
The possible options were A, it directly blocks H1 and H2 histamine receptors, preventing histamine binding. B, it stabilizes mast cells, preventing further histamine release into circulation. C, it counteracts histamine effects by reversing vasodilation and bronchioconstriction. D, it neutralizes circulating histamine by enzymatic degradation.
And let's talk about the answer. So the answer is, if you have been listening, you probably know. It counteracts histamine effects by reversing vasodilation and bronchoconstriction. So epinephrine does not block histamine receptors or degrade histamine directly. Instead, it counteracts the physiological effects of histamine by stimulating alpha-adrenergic receptors to reverse vasodilation and increase vascular tone, and beta-adrenergic receptors to reduce the bronchoconstriction and improve airway patency. So there you have it. Like I said, the answer is C. It counteracts histamine effects by reversing vasodilation and bronchoconstriction.
And that is why we also give a lot of other meds
yep.
during anaphylaxis. because we actually have to try to stop the histamine release and the histamine effects. And epi really just kind of gets us through in the meantime.
All right, so that's what we have for you on this episode of Life in Sirens. Wait, that's anaphylaxis? Yeah, it just might be. So please be sure to follow us on our socials. Those include Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and then we also can be found anywhere you listen to podcasts. And you can also buy some merch, which if you visit our socials, you can see where you can grab some awesome Life in Sirens gear. So stay safe. Blah, blah, blah.
And that is all we have.
See you next time. And I may learn how to speak between now and then.
This has been Life in Sirens, produced by three nerds trying to bring you content that you might actually care about.